Welcome to Open Hour. My name is Peter Robinson. I'm standing in this week for David Latulli, and we have a wonderful cast of characters to talk to about theatre, music, all happening here in the Bay Area. Shortly we'll have Bill Irwin in, who's going to be speaking about Samuel Beckett, and then Noah Griffin, president of the Cole Porter Society, will be discussing some of the songs and lyrics of Cole Porter. But to start with, it's my pleasure to welcome Lovesick. Lovesick, a new musical play based on the Song of Songs, which is premiering, it's a world premiere this January at two different Bay Area venues, one at the OSHA Center over in Berkeley, and then down at the Mountain View Center at the second stage. So welcome to both of you, Chris Renshaw, the director and the creator of the show. Tell me again your name.
Danielle.
Okay, Danielle. So let's start with the storyline, because when we see the word lovesick, you know, you conjure up all types of different images in the head of what lovesick may or may not mean. But this story, in fact, has like an ancient source to its foundation. Am I right in saying that?
Well, the story is made up, but it's based on ancient poetry.
Okay.
It's called as the Song of Songs.
Right.
And it's normally known, it's been recited on Friday prayers as a religious poetry, mm-hmm. known as a love story between God and the people of Israel. Mm-hmm. But its actual is a love story or a love poems between a man and a woman. Very sensual, erotic. Ancient and beautiful. Mm-hmm. So Lovesick draws from that poetry into a different narrative or new narrative, which I would call it a love story between a husband and his wife.
Okay, so it's a love story between a husband and a wife, but mm-hmm. it is based on original sources, which you get in the Song of David. I think that's
It's based on the poetry.
Poetry, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, let's talk a little bit about the music, because it is, as a musical, as where words come over the music. And maybe, Chris, you could say something about that.
Well, what attracted me deeply, because my career has been very much Broadway and West End, was the excitement of doing a musical with completely different style of music. It's what's called world fusion music. It's a fusion of Jewish, Arabic, flamenco. And I've never had the privilege of working with that type of cultural newness for me, especially as our musicians are sort of world-class Middle Eastern musicians mm-hmm. who actually learn the whole score and participate as actors. So it's completely integrated, a bunch of actors and a bunch of musicians, all of the very highest quality playing music that I believe is kind of one of the ways forward for the world as we try and join together and discover each other's cultures. So that's one of the reasons I did it, was to be involved in that type of musical fusion.
Yeah, I like the word fusion, because I think music can reach parts of the body that words sometimes don't get to. And you've got the musicians on stage throughout the production.
Indeed. The play is performed by what will appear to be a sort of tribe of either homeless or refugees who help tell Ofra's story. They're living somewhere. We think it might be in Tel Aviv. It could be anywhere where a group of people are condemned to be together or have the joy of being together, and they are inspired by this madwoman that Ofra plays, who's the sort of boss of the tribe. Mm-hmm. And so every day they recount her comic and tragic story of how she found love through these extraordinary old poems, which when I was my mum wouldn't let me read them, so because they were in the Bible, but I was always told to miss out the Book of Wisdom because it could lead to...
Because it had the good parts in it.
Yeah. Well, exactly. We did used to do that, because as soon as a kid you're told not to read something, the first thing I did was went up to my bedroom and read it.
And the page flipped open automatically.
It's amazing. And they're so old, and yet it's a very modern way of connecting a man and a woman. It's mm-hmm. it's also not very sexist. They're kind of equal. And you think about all those thousands of years before Christ of people writing in such a grown-up way about how to reach inside each other's brains and touch each other. I think it's a wonderful piece of work.
Good. Well, you've mentioned poetry, and I know you're the composer, the creator. Maybe you can give us a reference, a little introduction to a poem, and then an example of the poetry. At what point does she speak these lines?
Well, the poems are being recited or being sent to her as love letters by an anonymous stranger. So nobody really knows who's sending those poems, but they revive her life and transform her, and she discovers her sexuality and sensuality through those poems. Mm-hmm. And one of them, I think, is one of the most powerful one, is "Brand me upon your heart, sear me into your flesh and body, for love flames blazing as fire, jealousy burns cruel as hell, love's force strong as death. Many waters cannot put out the fires of love, rivers will not wash love away, yet all would mock the one who surrenders love's treasure for love."
Yeah, no, I think that's beautiful. I like the concept of brand me into your heart, and then to finish with the idea that love's rivers cannot put out the fire of love. So I think it's, even in those short few lines, you've got a sense of what the communications is. And then I'm going back to the idea that these mysterious letters, which turn up, almost love letters in the sand, I was going to say, are breezed in. And so as the story progresses, she finally discovers who the anonymous writer is, or is that part of the mystery?
I think that's part of the mystery. And when I first saw Ofra do this play in, she did a little workshop to present me it. I couldn't believe the twist that there is, and I was actually crying. So I think I wouldn't want to give that away, but she really, really falls in love with herself, her body. She discovers the pleasures of the body, but when she finds out what really happened, she's driven into madness. So let's put it that way. That's not giving too much away, yeah. I don't think.
No, well, we don't want any spoilers, but yeah. it is called a feminist or a viewpoint from a woman or a female point of view. Am I right in saying that's the essence of what we're looking at here?
Yeah, and you know, the show runs an hour and 20 minutes, but within that time period, you go through all the stages of from her being very young until she's very, very old, telling her story. And you see all those phases, and the music is really powerful, passionate. It's really like running a marathon doing this this play, and a combination of Middle East voices, almost, I would say, like a live band, like a live jam session.
You almost feel that it's improvised. So the idea being that, and some of it actually is improvised, which is another wonderful challenge for me as a director, but some of it, they are all working together to create the emotional high points in the music as they play together. Yeah. That's pretty exciting for me.
So the music is, if I understood it, is playing throughout the play.
Yeah,
pretty
much.
Then the words come in over the music at critical times.
That's
so
right.
Is there a sort of chanting quality to the music at all? Is that
Well, some of it's quite, some of it actually, it actually goes into very happy music too. You actually get into sort of real klezmer or related to klezmer. It's got some funny songs. The most haunting for me is when Ofra is speaking, and there's a wonderful actor, singer in it called Ali Paris, who plays an instrument called the kanun, which is the Arabic zither. Mm-hmm. And when Ofra is speaking and he's playing the zither and he improvises in a sort of Arabic
ornaments.
It's so beautiful, you know.
Yeah, I always think the zither does have a haunting quality
yes.
to it. I often remember the Harry Lime theme in The Third Man, nothing to
yes.
do with this, but that is the zither which is used to emphasize the mood. So I think
so
the zither
beautiful.
Can catch the mood of the piece.
Except I called Al, I said to Ali, is that a zither? And he got a bit offended. It's actually
yeah.
called the kanun.
Yeah.
So it's
the kanun. Okay, good, good. It's always good to be corrected on airing.
And also Ali brings a very, he's a soul, an ancient soul. And when he starts just a little bit, singing a little bit, you want to cry. Because
he's 25.
Very,
he's young, but with an old
soul. Very
deep
and moving in this Arabic, voices coming from long, long time ago.
Mm-hmm. And from your point of view, is there something of you in this story? You, the actor, actress, playing the play that you've created?
I don't know. I think there's a little bit of all of us in what we do, and sometimes I feel a little naked in front of everybody and saying, oh, they're going to think that about me and that. But then I feel it's my honor and obligation to serve it as deeply as I can and be daring.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, now, I know at the beginning we said it was set in a refugee camp in Tel Aviv, but it's also got a universal feel to it. So if I just look at the plight of refugees, the conditions in which they're living around the world, particularly in the Middle East, is there a kind of moment of relevance in this play as opposed to the ancient morals of the original story?
Well, I don't know that there are any ancient morals because, as I said, these are just love poems of longing and desiring.
Right.
But what was really fascinating to me as a playwright is when I read those poems, they're so perfect. Mm-hmm. They're perfect. They described a perfect body and the perfect love. So I said, the people who say those perfect must be imperfect themselves. So that's the polarity that I was interested in.
Mm-hmm. And what language, when you read them, were they originally written in?
ancient Hebrew.
Ancient Hebrew. And you did the translation
yes,
yourself.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In terms of an everyday audience, people who may not be familiar with the biblical and historic background to this, how would you say the play relates to today in 2016?
I think what people will hear is something completely different, and that's what I like about musicals, the way, you know, Hamilton is using rap, and I just think the musical has to progress and change and also be culturally very malleable. So I think an audience will have a very extraordinary experience hearing these sounds, and they're all around us. The guys and girls are walking in the audience and playing these beautiful magic sounds. And above all else, the story is very moving and about, especially from a women's point of view. And a guy couldn't have written this piece. I couldn't have written it because we probably wouldn't be allowed to write it because it's so particularly from a woman's point of view that only a woman can really do it, because she's quite criticizing of women. She's quite criticizing of the way women are treated. And that's what really turned me on. And I think an audience is going to be quite startled by the revelations of what a woman feels. And combined with this wonderful fusion stuff, I think it's going to be a very enlightening and new experience.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've done the play with focus groups or workshops, different types of people. What sort of feedback have you had from the attendees in the audience when you've done the preparations for this premiere?
Well, first, the audience would sit there and start, you know, jumping in their chairs and moving their bodies as
right.
they listen to the music because it's joyous.
Right.
And, you know, the Middle Eastern beat is just catchy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they are quite surprised, but in a positive way. It's quite unique.
Mm-hmm.
And
what's different here, though, from I did direct the final workshop, is now we have a cast of women around us, which we never had before, who integrate into the piece, and we also have two guys that represent some of the people that she's imagining or talking about. So this is really a very much a premiere of a new way of looking at this piece, of bringing it a little bit broader and bringing it, getting more commercial aspects into it. So in a way, this is really jumping in.
Okay. And there's 11 people in the cast, is that correct?
Yeah.
11 people, and they all have a kind of key part to play in terms of both being musicians
yes.
and being actors.
So it very much is an ensemble piece with Ofra really leading it as a great lady.
Well, we're going to go out with a piece from this current production, and just by introduction, maybe you can say a little bit about this piece that we're going to hear, which comes from the show, which is opening next week. It's called Love Sick. And also, before we go to that, give everybody the website that they can...
It's lovesickmusical.com.
Lovesickmusical.com.
And we open on January 19th.
Okay. And the two venues you're playing at?
the Osher Studio, downtown Berkeley, and Mountain View Center for the Arts.
Good. Okay, so now we're going to hear a little piece from the musical. And if you have any brief comments before we go into the music.
I just say that the song is in Hebrew, but the music you don't need to understand. You feel it.
You feel it. So now we're going to feel the music and swing around here in the studio. Okay, I'll wave you down and come in over the. Music from Lovesick. My guests today have been Ofra Daniel and Chris Renshaw. And I've got to say, the whole studio is vibrating back here because I think, as Ofra said, there is a kind of rhythm to this that gets you focused. The show opens next week. It's called Lovesick. And do you want to give us the website one more time?
Lovesickmusical.com.
Lovesickmusical.com. Well, that's easy enough. So
yeah.
I wish you both with a very interesting and very unique and unusual production. So thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, my next guest to open air, I'm Peter Robinson, standing in for David Latulli, is Bill Irwin, who's very much a Bay Area, whatever, actor, performer, trapeze artist, circus man. But in fact, he's going to be doing Beckett again. And anyone who can help me understand Beckett, it's going to start at ACT, is going to be my redeemer. So first of all, welcome, Bill. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's grand to be in your studio here. Grand to be in the city of San Francisco. The jet airplane got me here last night. And I have, like you said, I have lived here and come back to work. It's grand to be here.
Okay, now let me just begin, if I've got my facts right. You actually appeared in Sesame Street about 20 years ago. Is that right or wrong?
And in between times, too. Yes, I'm proud to be a Sesame Street regular.
Okay.
Of sorts.
And then when I look at your, I don't even want to call it a resume, it almost blows me away because I can't find anything that you haven't done yet, whether it's Law and Order. Rachel Getting Married, or Popeye, Eight Men Out, Silent Tongue. I mean, this is a person who can really adapt and be flexible. And I should add that as a person who's received both the MacArthur Fellows Award and the Choreographer's Fellowship Award, you bring so many different parts of you, literally body parts of you, to the stage. So let's start talking, if we can, about Beckett, and let's see if we can make some sense of what you think he is trying to say to audiences.
Well, before I presume to even attempt that, I'll just say he has lodged himself virally in my consciousness. I love his writings. I also grow really impatient with his writing, and I have to get away from it. It's claustrophobic sometimes, but it always draws me back. There is something that speaks to me. The Irish voice, he is the quintessential Irish voice. You know, when I went to school in Ireland a million years ago in the 60s, he was one of the writers you might think of as part of the Irish pantheon, but down a bit. Now he's maybe one of two, three quintessential Irish voices in literature, even though, and here we get into the mysteries, he wrote almost everything in French first, and then did his own translation to a sort of Irish-inflected English. It's just a voice and a set of writer's concerns that won't let me alone. So here I am back again with this piece called On Beckett, where I'll share with an audience a series of passages from the plays, the prose and the poetry, and some thoughts in between, and look at it all through the lens of a baggy pants comedian, because that is my calling card, that is my profession, even though, like I said, it's hard to make a living in it. But so it's Mr. Beckett, it's Mr. Beckett through a clown lens, and it is some of the most haunting language
there is. Let's talk about the clown section, because to me, Beckett essentially is words, words digested, words swallowed, words spat out, but you, on the other hand, are a body language person. So how do you find that middle ground between whatever we want to use, body language or figure language?
I know it sounds like a hard case to make, but Samuel Beckett is, and this is something that Carrie Perloff, my colleague and boss at ACT, says all the time. Beckett is a writer of the body. He's forever, sometimes endlessly, cataloging the body's shortcomings and his own. But he is one of the funniest writers there is, too. He and Baggy Pants comedians are drawn to each other, have been all through his working life and after his death. So like I say, it's a hard case to make, but he is funny. Mm-hmm. One of his great lines, this is not a fall down laughing, but it's the kind of thing that always brings a certain kind of smile to my face. He says, I shouldn't have begun. No, I had to begin. It's an existential question right in the middle of
I'll have to think about that one. and that's what I was wondering. I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot now, but is there a short passage that maybe, as your mind turns Beckett over?
My Lord, I have hours of it in my head. And so let me just say, you know, it's really active writing. Mm-hmm. So for an actor, it's exciting because there's always a launch. These pieces that I have become very deeply connected to, called Texts for Nothing, they're 13 little short prose pieces. Some Beckett scholars don't even care for it that much in his oeuvre, but I love it. Each one begins with a really punchy start. One is, when I think, no, that won't work. When come those who, it's an attempt. It's always an attempt to get somewhere. Another one begins, if I said there's a way out there, there's a way out somewhere, the rest would come. Mm-hmm. What am I waiting for then, to say it, to believe it? What does that mean, the rest? Now, shall I answer? Mm-hmm. Try and answer, or go on as though I'd ask nothing. I don't know. See, it may sound to you like I'm sort of riffing and talking my own language. That's word for word his text. It's a very active, I think, sort of interior monologue text, because Beckett was, this is one of my little axes to grind, he was really interested in the workings of the mind. He studied Descartes. He was interested in psychology. He went into psychoanalysis himself after his father died. And the bereavement, the depth of the bereavement he found there. He's interested, amongst other things, in how the mind works, the different voices in the mind, the old me, myself, and I when we were kids. And I think that is something that physical anthropology is beginning to catch up with. People are saying, oh yeah, maybe human consciousness began as an argument within each mind. So, you know, the early early mammalists saying, yeah, I'll go for that food. No, no, it's too far out there. No, stay behind the rock. You're safer. Yeah, but I'm hungry. Everything is an interior debate, and that's how his... Here's a stretch from Waiting for Godot, one mm-hmm. of the most famous pieces he right, ever wrote. Yeah. Was I sleeping while the others suffered? Am I sleeping now? Tomorrow when I wake or think I do, what shall I say of today? It's a really active little interior debate. It's also, as we poise ourselves here at the beginning of 2017, it's a bit of citizenship catalog, like, what shall I say of today?
I think it's really interesting combining your schooling in Ireland, his translating a very logical language, the French,
yes.
into the very mystical language of the Irish. I mean, you go into a pub in Dublin and you say, can you tell me where the Duke of Wellington is? I said, oh, well, you have to go right here. No, you have to go left. No, you have to go the other side of the road and cross when you get to the petrol station. And then and I say, thank you.
Yeah. In Ireland, I don't know whether this is still the case, but when I was there, they would say, it's about a quarter mile. Anything you could walk in half a day was a quarter mile. And you're right. There's a sort of mystical mm-hmm. dimension to
and
that.
And they will go with you on the walk, and then you want to know how to shake them off.
I can see where you spent time.
So I think this idea of the brain making the connection, it's what I call turning subconscious thought into active thinking.
Aha, aha, yes, yes. Mm. Well, and how those, the semi-conscious, the subconscious, the unconscious, how it all acts on our decisions to move this cup from there to there, to look you in the eye or not look you in the eye. Yeah. These are the human questions, and for actors, it's just... it's meat and potatoes.
Because I think he reverses the Hamlet soliloquy to be or not to be. It's being, and I think it's that land in the middle where, well, if I do this, I'm going to do that, but if I don't do the other, I should have done the first thing anyway. You know, so it's making indecision a virtue.
That's it. Well, it's making it a very active... a very active pursuit. Indecision as a really active activity. Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. I agree.
So if we say thinking about thinking on this production that you're going to be doing at ACT, I know you mentioned the 13 texts.
Yes.
We're going to have snatches from Happy Days. Are we?
Happy Days is not a work that I've ever worked with. Snatches from Waiting for Godot. And, of course, mm-hmm. you have to enter the whole debate about how you pronounce the title of that play. Most Americans say Godot. And yeah. there are great arguments for that, by the way. Most Brits and Irish say Godot. And there are great arguments for that. And it kind of launches you in what the central jokes in the play are. So I've taken my position, and I'll stake it out in the course of the evening.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of waiting, you're actually in God's waiting room because there's no movement in Waiting for Godot.
Oh, I disagree.
Okay, good.
It's actually a very active play. And like any great play, because I had the great fortune to work with Edward Albee's plays, foremost among them Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Mm-hmm. It's one of those plays that people talk forever and then suddenly there's a flash of violence. It's the same thing in Waiting for Godot. You think, I see, this is all about people talking because they don't know what else to do, and it's disembodied voices, and suddenly there's a man being dragged across the stage by another man because he has a rope around his neck. It is holding the world of human relationships up to a mirror mm-hmm. in, I think, the most active and, for me, the most beguiling way. Other people can say, and I sympathize with him, you know, he's not my cup of tea, but he's a writer who will not let me alone. Mm-hmm. And I like, if I can respectfully disagree, it's full of action. It's full of silhouette. He describes people's bodies in a way that gives an actor or an audience a particular, I can't do it here justice here on the radio, but it gives a particular signature to mm-hmm. to the body and the silhouette of a body. His stage directions, I think, are some of his best writing.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of timing, because I think timing, when you both read Beckett to yourself, but above all when you're performing
yes.
Beckett, the pauses and the other inflections are really important.
They're very important, and he was... It's almost a relief that he's released this a little bit, but he was very strict when he would direct. The difference between three dots and the word pause and the word silence. They were each to be given a particular kind of value. He was, by the way, quite an accomplished musician and is often sort of overlooked. The one time I briefly met him in Paris toward the end of his life, I was so shy that I couldn't take my hands, I couldn't take my eyes off of his hands on the table. I couldn't look him in the eye. Mm-hmm. But his hands were gnarled at that time with arthritis, and as I get older, I see
feel of it.
I do.
The backbone's connected to your thigh bone.
Yes, and what the arthritis does to that, and I could see that he was a man who couldn't play the piano as once he had played.
Played. Yeah. So the area of what I call physicality, does this production or the pieces you're doing, does it leave scope for doing some of the clowning that you've been famous for in previous productions?
Yes. Whether it's a good idea or not, I'm bringing them together. So, like I say, it's Mr. Beckett's language as seen through the lens of a baggy pants comedian, and my pants, not to give anything too much away, but my pants get baggier through the course of the evening. Mm-hmm. And there is a point in the evening where I have to invoke a soft shoe dance, partly to get away from
the intensity
of his language. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But everything always leads me back to his language.
Yeah. No, I also happen to like tap dance myself.
Do you?
Yeah. I think it's a great way of connecting the feet to the head.
It is indeed. It is indeed. And you can tell yourself rhythms, but until you can play them out through the feet, they don't entirely inhabit your body. My thing is, I'm so glad to hear you're a tap dance enthusiast. I'm not a tap dancer. I'm a soft shoe artist. It's more age appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a form I love, the elegance of it. It seems as far away as possible from Samuel Beckett's worlds, but in fact, I think they do intersect.
They do, yeah. And I would just finish with this. I'm going to ask you in a second to do another possible piece.
Sure.
But before that, let's talk about rhythm in Beckett's writing, because I think the rhythm is partly the way the content becomes more active in people's minds.
I do, too. It's also one of the only handholds you have in committing his language to memory. You know, the few actors, Mr. Connor Lovett is a wonderful Beckett interpreter. Barry McGovern is an Irish guy. We get together sometimes and we've said between us we probably have 6 or 7 hours of Beckett words in memorization. The only hope that they're much better at it than I. The only hope I have is the active rhythm, as you say. The beginning of, here's the famous Lucky speech character, okay, who doesn't speak throughout the play except at one point he's commanded by his master to think.
Mm-hmm.
He speaks for 3 pages before they have to drag him down
and take
him off the stage. Quiet, shut him up. Yeah. But he starts. It's a beautiful parody of academia. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you can feel the sort of emotional intensity and say, he says, given the existence as uttered forth in the public works of Puncher and Wattman of a personal god, qua, 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 with white beard, qua, 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 outside time, without extension, it goes on like that for 3 pages. But if you look at that and say, I got to memorize this, until you get a hold of a rhythm, there is no hope.
Well, I think we're all looking forward to it. This is Bill Owen, who we've been talking to. His one-man interpretation of On Beckett opens at ACT next week. And I think as a clown, I'm really interested in seeing what the body does. As a listener, I love his voice. So again, Bill, I want to thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for giving us these statues. And I'm sure it'll all be okay on the night. You know, what do you think of that now?
I'm going to take your assurance and run with it in an American voice at this moment. But I thank you for that Irish assurance, because Lord, can I use it.
Okie dokie. Good. Good to have you here, Bill.
So good to be here. Thanks.
Thank you.
On Plymouth Rock, if today any shock they should try to
landing on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock would land on there. In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. But now God knows anything goes. Good offers to who once knew better words, now only used for letter words, writing prose. Anything goes. If driving fast cars you like, if low bars you like, if old hymns you like, if fair limbs you like, if Mae West you like, or me undressed you like, why nobody will oppose. When every night the set that smart is in.
Yeah, and welcome back to Open Hour. I'm Peter Robinson, standing in for David Latulli. And anything goes, so it's my great pleasure today to have Noah Griffin, who is the president of the Cole Porter Society, to just share some thoughts and ideas about Cole Porter's music, the lyrics, the verse, how he came to write what. And let's start with Anything Goes, which I think was probably one of his great hits.
Yes, it was, and he didn't really much care for his own voice, and occasionally he would record, but the words that he used are just so unique and so different. The kinds of love songs that he wrote, comparing people to writing low bars you like, if low bars you like, if Mae West you like, or me undressed you like. It just went on and on. He had a very mischievous and irreverent mind. Got him in a lot of trouble during the day. They had to censor a lot of his songs. Love for Sale, for instance, it could only be played in instrumental form for so many years.
And there were other versions of Let's Do It, too, which maybe we can't get away with on the air.
Well, the song was so risque at the time, they couldn't just have the title Let's Do It. They had to add Let's Do It, Let's Fall in Love. In fact, I brought you some that the Yale Whiffenpoofs are coming to town this month on the 9th through the 11th. And these are some of the lyrics that they came up with Yale at other different times, none of which you can use on the air.
Okay, so now we
changed a few around. Birds Do It, Bees Do It, First Timers Who Lack an Expertise Do It. That's when I added to it.
Noel Coward also had his own version of Let's Do It.
Did he really?
Yes, which again, I think we're going to have to restrict.
Well, Noel is interesting. They had the same number of letters in their name. Both died at 73, and both were probably the most sophisticated writers of their era, without
Absolutely.
A doubt.
Now, talking about writers, part of what the Cole Porter Society does is really help students in schools to understand the value of his language and appreciate some of the sentiments that he was talking about.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think they think that rap began and ended with them. And so when I go into schools, I make them look at me as not the old fuddy-duddy that I probably am, but I start off with something called the Julius Caesar rap, which gets them in the mood of learning Cole Porter. It goes, Julie was a gangster guy back in 44 B.C. The senators from Rome all knew he would not go easy. Julie just came back from France. He had lots of gall. Now he came, he saw, he conquered there. He desired all. Now Senate said to Julius, he stay out of this region. But Julie crossed the Rubicon with his Roman legion. Calpurnius said to Julius, he heed the old soothsayer. But Julie didn't listen. No, he said he didn't care. She pleaded with him, Julie, babe, don't go to the forum. But all those pleas and warning signs, he chose to ignore him. He said to her, now chill out, chick, get off my back, Calpurnia. With all this negativity, you're giving me a hernia. Jumped into his chariot, rode past the Colosseum, through the town where all roads lead so all the folks can see him. Meanwhile, noble Brutus plots with Cassius lean and hungry. Such men are dangerous, it's true, if you make them angry. Julie, now crowned emperor, from the Senate swaggers, but blinded by the laurel leaves, he does not see the daggers. The fatal blades rain down until he looks like Tutti Frutti, and when the fatal blow is struck, he yells at A2 Brutti. The moral is a good wife says, don't go out, stay home, and her love in arms do what she says. By all means, don't go Roman. So you get all the kids clapping to that, and snapping their fingers. Then you go into one of the Cole Porter List songs, and they see the relationship between the two. And with the previous rap, they're learning history at the same time.
Yeah,
and as Cole Porter linked a lot of history in his songs.
Yeah, and I was thinking of Brush Up Your Shakespeare, which in a way is a way of getting people who may never see anything other than Kiss Me, Kate, finally go to the real production. Yeah.
Well, you know, when he went to Yale, you know, he had to take a test in those days to qualify to go to the university, and he scored very poorly in Greek. And so that, they think, is the impetus for writing the verse to Brush Up Your Shakespeare. the girls today in society go for classical poetry, so to win their hearts one must quote with ease Aeschylus and Euripides. One must know Homer, and believe me, Bo, Sophocles also Sappho. If you don't know Shelley and Keats and Pope, Danny Dubbies will call you a dope.
Right.
And it goes on.
Yeah, yeah. So you suddenly get a Liszt song in its own context.
That's right. Absolutely.
But they're
right.
All classical characters, or in terms of the play, they're individuals that could appear in a Shakespearean production.
And it shows you what a wonderful education he had. I mean, he had a very broad education. Very few writers in those days had the kind of education that Cole Porter did. They went into another field. A lot of them came up in the Lower East Side of New York, and immigrants really struggling hard to make it. And Cole was seen as a dilettante at that time, because he'd throw these things off, and people would say they didn't take much time to do, and truly that they didn't. But he had to work very hard on them. It was not just the dilettante people thought.
Well, we're going to cut to a Cole Porter number now. It's You'd Be So Easy to Love. This particular one is by Frank Sinatra, and I think it may be worth speaking a little bit about his own personal life, which, because the songs in many ways reflect what was going on in his life at that time.
Absolutely.
You'd be so easy to love, so easy to idolize all others above, so worth the yearning for. So swell to keep every home fire burning for. And we would be so grand at the game, carefree together, that it does seem a shame that you can't see your future with me. 'Cause you'd be, oh, so easy to love.
Yeah, so what about the background to this particular song?
Well, this was originally written for Anything Goes, and the censors objected to one of the lyrics. It was, so sweet to awaken with, so nice to sit down to eggs and bacon with. And they didn't care for that, so we had to change it to so worth the yearning for, so swell to keep every home fire burning for. And this was actually used in a picture entitled Born to Dance, starring Jimmy Stewart, who thought that the notes were a little high for him. He wanted to knock some of the notes down a bit. He wouldn't. But by and large, Cole would write for the particular individual that was going to sing the song, and he loved Ethel Merman. Of the 13 musicals that she starred in, 6 were Cole Porter's. Mm-hmm. He said that she could flat or sharp the same note that he wrote, and she would never vary what he wrote. And you could hear him not only at the back of the theater, not only at the back of the theater that they were doing the production, but the back of the theater across the street. Her voice was loud. In those days, they did not have microphones, mm-hmm. so you had to be heard. That was one of the reasons that he almost
didn't. Ethel Merman would be heard wherever she was.
That's right.
So I wonder what was wrong with eggs and bacon with. I mean, it ends with the word with. But
well, the problem is it's so worth so sweet to awaken with. So that implies that they weren't married, that they had an affair. Then the next morning they were awakening to eggs and bacon. So the censors were very active in those days, very active. Mm-hmm. And Cole would test them as much as he could.
Oh, he pushed it to the hilt.
Yes, he did.
Well, another song of his, which again has undergone many different interpretations, is You're the Top.
And oh, my God.
how you want to speak about who's the top, who's the bottom, and what does the word bottom actually mean in this particular song? It creates all that type of mysterious je ne sais quoi, which perhaps he intended from the very beginning.
I'm so pathetic that I always have found it best, instead of getting them off my chest, to let them rest unexpressed. I hate parading my serenading, as I'll probably miss a bar. But if this ditty is not so pretty, at least it'll tell you how great you are. You're the top. You're the Colosseum. You're the top.
You're the Louvre Museum. You're the melody from a symphony by Strauss. You're a Bendel bonnet, a Shakespeare sonnet. You're a Mickey Mouse.
Well, that of course, is the great Ella Fitzgerald, whose, I think, articulation on this song really gets the words across, and the words are really vitally important.
Well, Cole Porter so much appreciated her work. They were going to do a one-year tribute to her at the Smithsonian American History. It wound up being 6 years, and there was a personal letter from Cole Porter to Ella Fitzgerald thanking her for singing his songs on the Great American Songbook, Ella Does Cole Porter. And just this week in the San Francisco Chronicle, they talked about what was happening in 1955 at the Fairmont Hotel. Ella Fitzgerald had just discovered Cole Porter. Now, and she was doing a whole program of his. Looking up some about You're the Top, Margaret Case Harriman of The New Yorker said that the whole thing originated because Cole and Mrs. Alastair McIntosh were entertaining themselves by making up superlatives that rhymed. So he put this together, and at the height of the song's popularity, over 300 parodies a week would come into Cole Porter on You're the Top. The one that was really fun was the one that Irving Berlin sent to him. If you want, I can do
yes,
it.
Yes, yeah, let's hear rather few words.
You're the top, you're a high colonic, you're the top, you're Miss Pinkham's tonic, you're the burning heat of a bridal suite in use, you're the breasts of Venus, you're King Kong's, you're self-abuse.
Yes, self-abuse. Well, good for Irving Berlin. Yeah. No, I think the humor in his lyrics, and also when I say the topicality, the fact that he can include Disney, he can include
yes.
fashion, is a way where what was becoming sort of slick slang has a sort of elegance that raises above everyday speak, but they became phrases or expressions that would then find the way back into everyday speech.
You're absolutely right. Cellophane was one that he used. Or he spoke of Irene Bordoni, somebody who was very popular at the time. She was the star of Paris, where the song Let's Do It originated, and also Let's Misbehave originated. He talked about Mickey Mouse, as you mentioned, who just Steamboat Willie. Just it just come out. So people were really, it's kind of a sociological time capsule when he writes a song. You can get so much from what was going on in the period. In fact, one of the songs, he eliminates some of the people that he talks about in the song because a tragedy happened. Mrs. Lindbergh, for instance, he takes her out of one of the songs because the Lindbergh kidnapping had occurred.
Right, yeah.
So
yeah.
He's very much sensitive to what was going on at the time and also what public taste would accept and not accept.
Mm-hmm. And I think his storytelling qualities, both in the music and in the musicales, they had a purpose. They were not simply what I call song and dance sort of movie type stuff. They actually presented situations about love, betrayal, expectations, loss. And I think his music speaks to all those different types of emotions. So I say there's a lot of emotion in
with a great
Cole
deal
Porter.
Of passion. No mm-hmm. question about it. That's what he was appreciated for. I mean, he knew all aspects of love. And one of the reasons Tony Bennett likes him so much, he said he was always falling in love. I was on Indiana television, and someone said, well, how was he always falling in love? Wasn't he married? Yes, but he was gay, and he was always falling in love. And so it's kept a certain freshness to his music.
Mm-hmm. And then his own life had its own tragedy. He had that tragic horse riding accident.
In 1937, and I think he should be a hero to the disabled community, he had over 34 different operations. His wife and his mother got together and decided under no circumstances should they cut that leg off. And it wasn't until 1958 when osteomyelitis set in and both his mother and his wife had passed that the doctors insisted. From 1958 until he died in 64, he never wrote another note.
Oh, my goodness.
So they knew something about him he didn't know. And now when he wrote his crowning glory, Kiss Me, Kate, in 1948, that was when all the other composers really had a lot of respect for him because he had come back from this serious illness, from this serious infirmity to rise to the top. And that was the first Tony Award that was ever given. And we gave our first Cole Porter Lifetime Achievement Award last year to Patricia Morrison, the first Kate in Kiss Me, Kate, in March on her 101st birthday.
Oh, my goodness. And what state was she in at 101?
She's very, very, very sharp. She lives down in Hollywood, has been in the same place since 1965. We gave her a cigarette case, the type that Cole Porter's wife would give him at the opening of every one of his musicals, not bejeweled as he would, but nonetheless with her name on it. And we have a picture of her accepting it, which is just wonderful.
And I also think with Kiss Me, Kate, I mean, it does stay very close to The Taming of the Shrew when you think
about it.
So you get the best of Cole Porter and maybe the best of Shakespeare all in one sweep, you know.
Well, he was very reluctant to put a musical to Shakespeare. I mean, who would want to partner with Shakespeare? Who would think that you could? Mm-hmm. But Bella Spivak and her husband just stayed on him, and it turned out to be his finest work. I was told someone, Tilly DeLemer, told me he made a $500 investment in that. It was the best investment he ever made.
Mm-hmm. Now, how many of the tunes, I can't remember this, in High Society had their origins with Cole Porter?
Oh, they all did. They all did. But, right. You know, it's interesting enough you mentioned High Society because two of his simplest songs were his biggest sellers and most popular. Of course, True Love, sung
by Bing Crosby.
Bing Crosby.
In a yacht.
Kelly.
On a yacht.
That's right. And they didn't dub her voice, and she was very pleased that they allowed her to sing the song.
Mm-hmm. And then there is the Frank Sinatra element in the,
well,
in the movie.
Well, did you
ever? Yes. What a swell party this is. Yeah. I get a kick from Champagne. I think, was that? No, that wasn't in that one. That was a different one, if I remember.
It was. And that was the one where, that was from Anything Goes. And mm-hmm. Billy Crocker was actually used in that from the Crocker Estate and the Crocker Bank. He'd gone to Yale with Cole, and they graduated both in the class of 1913. And, of course, the Billy Crocker pursues Hope Harcourt, stowing away on an ocean liner with the help of an evangelist turned nightclub singer, Reno Sweeney, and Public Enemy Number 13, Moonface Martin. At any rate, the show debuted November 21st, 1934, and then the film version in 1936 with Ethel Merman and William Gaxton. A lot of is made of it, talking about cocaine, some like to, and those were actual the lyrics. Now, people have changed them over the years. Some like the perfume from Spain, or some like the bebop refrain. But the line that he changed is, I get no kick in a plane. I shouldn't care for those nights in the air that the fair Mrs. Lindbergh goes through. So he changed that. Flying too high with some gal in the sky is my idea of nothing to do because of the Lindbergh tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's hear, if we can, Peggy Lee and her version of I Get a Kick Out of You.
I get no kick from champagne. Mere alcohol doesn't thrill me at all. So tell me, why should it be true that I get a kick out of you? Some like that perfume from Spain. I'm sure that if I took even one sniff, it would bore me terrifically too. Yet I get a kick out of you. I get a kick every time I see you standing there before me. I get a kick, though it's plain to see you obviously don't adore me. Some get their kicks in a plane, flying too high with some guy in the sky. Is my idea of nothing to do. Yet I get a kick out of you. No kick in a plane, high with some guy in the sky is my idea of nothing to do. Yet I get a kick out of you. Ooh, I get a kick out of you.
Well, there's a very upbeat version of I Get a Kick Out of You with Peggy Lee. And I understand you actually interviewed her some time ago. Is that right?
It was some time ago. I remember her from my youth, from Ladies of Tramp, We Are Siamese, if you please this song. Mm-hmm. And she had some respiratory issues at that time. And when she was on the stage at the Venetian Room, she had kind of a windblower coming. And I've read the biography, her biography, quite something. She was very exacting, very much a professionalist, a perfectionist, and a lot of folks didn't want to work with her because of that. But when you get a Peggy Lee recording, it's excellent.
Yeah. Okay. And if people want to get in touch with the Cole Porter Society, what is the best website for them to reach?
www.thecoleportersociety.org, or they can reach me directly at noah@thecoleportersociety.org. We do have a Cole Porter concert coming up at the Golden Gate Yacht Club on March the 5th. It'll be totally Cole Porter.
Okay, so that's something to look forward to in March. And again, I want to thank my guests for coming in today, Noah Griffin, who is president of the Cole Porter Society.
Thank you so much for having me, Peter.
Now, I've got a couple of brief announcements. At the Sausalito Library, I'm presenting an evening called Songs That Tell a Story. And we're going to be looking at every type of ballad, protest songs from the 60s, including Bob Dylan. And then we're moving into some of the things we've heard today, some of the great poets of Tin Pan Alley, and again, how their songs told a different type of story, but still told a story. So we're going from the days of Ireland, the emigration issues, the leaving of Liverpool, the rising of the moon, and then we're going to head back into the 1920s and 1930s. And these are all songs which, in certain ways, are part of the social history, the fabric of the times, that explain how people get along and what they do under their different conditions. So as one different take on love, here's a song that tells a slightly different story.
I'm just a gigolo, and everywhere I go,
gigolo,
people
gigolo,
know the part
gigolo,
I'm playing.
Gigolo, gigolo,
pay for every dance,
gigolo,
selling each romance.
Gigolo,
oh,
gigolo,
what they're saying.
Gigolo, gigolo, gigolo.
And there will come a day when you will pass away. What will they say about me?
When the end comes, I know they'll say just a gigolo.
Life goes on.
Well, I'm just a gigolo, and that's it for Open Air this week. My name's Peter Robinson, standing in for David Latuli, who will be back next week. I want to thank our producer, Neil Swingles, who's brought everybody together today, and Eric Jansen for doing the studio engineering, which has kept us on air by the seat of our pants, one way or the other. And now, coming up at 2 o'clock, is the BBC News World Service from the BBC. Again, thank you for listening. Peter Robinson.